welcome to the Robot Love Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of Robot Love. My name is Brian Mateo Venegas, and as promised, I have a very special guest tonight. And I'm going to give you a few clues. I've known her for 4 years. I may or may not be married to her.
It feels longer than 4 years.
It does, doesn't it?
I mean that in the sweetest, most loving way possible.
That's her. Silent Stack.
Hi, everyone.
She is my wife, and she is my best friend, and she has been one of the greatest supporters of my podcast. There have been times when I'm like, what am I going to do next? How am I going to get to have someone call me at a certain time, the time zones and so forth? And she has always said, you know, just keep going. And she says, look at the places that you have people following you. So I really appreciate the opportunity to sit down with you and talk about one of our favorite shows, Unsolved Mysteries.
Yes. A show that has been such a big part of both of our lifetimes and anyone who grew up in our age groups.
Grew up in our age group and...
lifetime.
Just everything from just being completely bonkers and scary to tragic to a tear-jerky moment with, you know, people being reunited after 50 years with siblings that were...
The full gamut.
And,
of,
you know,
emotions, of just odd tangents the story could go, and just gets to the essence of what it means. You know, this is probably cheesy, but gets to the essence of what it means to be a human being on some level, because you have this element of the unknown, and just kind of frames your world thinking on some level, especially when you're talking about otherworldly things and
things that
inhumanity and just things that as a core human being kind of make you question everything.
And the spookies.
And the spookies.
Spookies and the scaries, as my family would say, spookies.
Ryan's side of the family likes to call things a spooky.
It's spooky. So what I want to do is jump into our first one. And it's about reincarnation. I love this one. And this one, I had been bugging Eileen to watch, and we finally did, and it's fantastic. I won't go into too much detail, but it's basically about a gentleman named Bruce Kelly who had started to experience phobias, fear of water, fear of swimming pools, even the fear of going into the bathtub, having these premonitions of death related with water. So he goes to a hypnotist who performs a past life regression as a therapy, and all these memories come rushing back to him. He's in World War II. He's on the submarine, the USS Shark. He is
Shark.
As in the fish.
Yep.
His name is James Edward Johnson. He knows his rank. He knows where he's from. He knows the other shipmate that's drowning with him.
Mm-hmm.
He remembers the water rising and being trapped after having several death charges go off outside of the submarine. So he remembers his death, which is chilling.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, he starts to remember other details about his life. So he remembers his hometown. He remembers the house he grew up in, which was still standing at the time that he went to visit the town with his hypnotist and the cameraman.
Mm-hmm.
He remembers very odd things, like that he was kind of a second-class citizen in his family, so he had to use the back door.
Yeah.
He'd have to go work or do whatever he was doing. He was in the Civil Engineering Corps, which was pretty common for people before World War II, and he'd have to come through the back door. And there was one thing that he would go to snack as soon as he went into the kitchen, is the ends of the bread.
Which is weird. Like, who does that?
Who does that? It's a very peculiar thing. It may have had something
If it's like Wonder Bread.
What? Wonder Bread.
I imagine.
Whatever else, in the 40s, it could have been actual real bread. But at that time, I think that they were processing bread that suspiciously didn't go bad for like 2 weeks. We have hot dog buns and stuff that have been around for 2 weeks. So as a side note. The family of James Edward Johnson kind of caught wind of this and were just blown away, especially by the details about the fact that he knew where his house was. He knew about the going through the back door. he has memories of the day that his mother died, and his cousin, who's still alive, remembers the scene precisely as is recalled by Bruce Kelly, which just blew everyone's mind. And this family was...
His cousin.
His cousin was there. Yeah, his cousin was there the day that his mom died.
Weird.
And Bruce Kelly described the scene exactly as it happened, and that kind of blew her mind.
Yeah, because how would he have even come in contact with this cousin? And
from a completely different town.
That would be a very elaborate ruse to pull off, right?
Well, and
especially in this time era where it's like you can't just Google someone online.
No, not
find
at all.
Because it was early 80s or...
Yeah, well, it had been documented to his hypnotist that this name came up. And subsequently, Bruce Kelly went to the library and they had the scene of him pulling up all the books, which is hilarious because that's how he had to use...
That's how he found out about...
Yeah, he went through, found the USS Shark after a while and you know, found the roll call of everybody and saw James Edward Johnson. And they showed James Edward Johnson's face, his picture, which is kind of chilling.
Mm-hmm.
And so as far as the episode, that's probably all the information that you need to know. But what I want to know, Eileen, is what your thoughts are about reincarnation.
That's a tough one. I'm going to probably give a long-winded answer without a very clear answer, but I'll at least attempt it.
It's your time.
So, this one, like, watching it with you, you know, you have this individual who seems like a stand-up citizen. He's very kind, from what I can tell, through the television screen. He doesn't look like somebody who's out for fame or wants his, like, you know, moments on television. He seems like a nice guy. And so knowing that there's no gain he's getting out of telling this story, it makes it more compelling and more believable. But reincarnation is one of those things where with everything, you know, about life and what happens to us after we die, as I get older and older, my thoughts become more nebulous and I waffle a lot. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, I'm probably agnostic, but if I look at the grand scheme of things and, you know, across worldviews, reincarnation is a part of a lot of religions. It's a component of many people's understanding of the afterlife. And I think, you know, there's a sense of comfort it maybe brings because it gives you this sense that even if somebody is passed on, they may have an opportunity to live on this earth again or be a part of your life again in some capacity. They might reappear as a different person or in some cultures a place or a thing, but they're there in some sense of being. And so I think it's comforting. I think people kind of see it as a way of just making sense of things. And, you know, the people in this story, you could tell they were like...
They were excited.
They were excited.
And they weren't necessarily people that... They admitted they weren't people that necessarily believed in reincarnation.
No. So, you know, watching their reactions, it makes it all the more believable. But for me personally, I waffle, and there's the other side of me that's a cynic, and, you know, is it just people trying to rewrite a story so that they feel better about all these unknowns? But then, you know, I think about it in terms of just how much there remains to be known about this world and this universe, and it's like, why wouldn't it be possible too, you know, like...
Yeah.
And...
Well, I would say, and you and I talked about this offline, is that I have a little bit of conflicting thoughts about reincarnation because in an ideal scenario, you go to heaven, mm-hmm. and you're at peace eternally. Mm-hmm. So is it punishment,
mm-hmm.
or some type of reward to be reincarnated and come back to the earth? And instinctually, I think, well, maybe it's a little bit of a learning curve. You have to go back until you learn the things that you need to learn.
Right.
But at the same time, that's scary because you go through your life and you struggle to kind of figure out why you're on this planet, and you think that you've come to some, you hope that you've come to some conclusions, and you've mm-hmm. done the things you can in the best way and be as kind as possible, and then boom, you're right back on Earth.
Yeah.
It's kind of a
you're right.
Sisyphean task of just having the boulder go back down the other side of the mountain.
You're right. There's like this moral attachment to it. Like in Buddhism, you have that element of karmically, if you were a good person in one life, you'll come back and have a good, that essentially sets you up for a good life in the future. But then you also have like other cultures that think about it from the standpoint of reincarnation rooted in like reciprocity. And so cultures that believe that when you're reincarnated, you're not necessarily, your soul doesn't go into another being's soul, but your soul might go into the environment or your physical world. And so the way you treat the land you use, the animals that are your sustenance has moral implications. So if you think about these things as your ancestors in a way, then you're maybe more obliged to treat them respectfully. So there's like so many different variations of the concept that, again, it just, my mind just kind of goes in a rabbit hole, and I won't say that it's not possible, but
well, I think you're saying that anything's possible, but in your perspective, maybe this is not one thing you think is actually true.
Yeah, this one for me remains unsolved.
You are something else.
Yeah.
Unsolved. Stamp. Cool. Well, I think that covered quite a bit about that subject, and that story makes me smile. I know that there are things in it that are extremely tragic, but to think that the family, like thousands of families in World War II that had lost people, that you don't even hear these stories.
Mm-hmm.
To see this story of someone that chose within his branch to serve in one of the scariest things besides a rocket that I can think of doing, which is a combination of things that I'm deathly afraid of, which is being underwater and being in a small space.
Yeah, not for everybody.
These guys are tough as nails. And, ultimately, unfortunately, people who were serving submarines sometimes have to face those things in the time when they pass. So I think that from there we can move on to our next story.
Yeah, I have one related to water. We can keep the theme of water going.
That sounds good. All right. Well, we will move on.
So this story actually has a bit of a connection with my family. A little bit of a removed connection, but let's run with it. So,
go with it.
This story is about Woody Kelly. He actually lived in my hometown, Antioch, Illinois. My parents actually knew of Woody Kelly, who was a parishioner at the church my family went to. And
two Kellys in a row. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, two Kellys in a row involving water. Weird.
Mysterious. Keep going.
Very mysterious. But so this is a story of fraud, we think.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely fraud.
Fraud and a disappearance story. So on June 8th, 1985, Woody Kelly's yacht was found abandoned in Lake Michigan. There was no sign of his body, no sign of Kelly anywhere to be found. His favorite aviators that he was frequently...
His trademark,
photograph wearing and always had on when he was out in the water, were left behind on the boat. So Police investigated. They sent out a search party. They didn't find anything. So there was this big mystery around his death. Did he accidentally drown? Was he murdered? What happened to him? The mystery took a turn when, right before this all happened, about a week prior, one of his clients, Woody Kelly was a financial advisor. One of his clients was suing him in a civil suit, basically saying that he committed fraud.
Ponzi.
The Ponzi scheme, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so the police, learning this information, started looking into his accounts. Kelly was a very popular individual within the community. Everyone knew him or knew of him. He was a very likable character. He was growing his business. He was doing very well. They start looking into his accounts. They realize that he was basically spending all of his clients' money, and he was pocketing their money.
As it came in.
Yeah. All in all, they estimated that he stole roughly $6 million. He had started accumulating all these things.
Goofy stuff.
Toys, as you do when you have too much money. Yeah. He had a Mercedes, a Jaguar, 5 yachts, multiple airplanes.
And no one notices.
Actually, people did notice. I was asking my mom about this.
A little background. This happened in your hometown.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. As I mentioned, it happened in my hometown. I was asking my mom about it. She remembered the case every time it would come on, because they would re-air on occasion. She would say, like, oh yeah, we knew them. And she was telling me that at one point they lived within our neighborhood or near our neighborhood, and she remembers, like, them becoming more and more wealthy and, like, them starting to acquire new things, and then all of a sudden they moved out of the neighborhood. And so, like, she kind of alluded to, like, this shift in character where all of a sudden he was becoming flashier. But anyways, they go to his accounts. They can't find any. They can find evidence that he's committing fraud. And they just basically start to assume, like, somebody either murdered him, like a partner, a business relationship that was nefarious to begin with and had gone, like, completely awry, or that he escaped his... What is that? Like, escaped his death. Like, he...
Yeah, he faked his death.
He faked his death, and...
Lake Michigan, it's a little difficult because it's so rough. It's so cold.
Yeah, like, he would have had to... Well, this is June. This is summer, so...
Oh, okay.
He would have had to have somebody, like, meet him there and, you know, all the...
Miami Vice type stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So...
A cigarette boat and a helicopter and...
But the sad thing is that... He had a wife and kids, and mm-hmm. his family were left behind to deal with all of this. And, you know, I don't know if they knew what was going on, but his wife was trying to have him legally declared dead because she couldn't access his insurance policy. So she, for years, was...
She's straddled with debt.
Yeah, straddled with debt.
Yeah.
And, you know, not only dealing with the loss of her husband, but also dealing with the fact that, you know, in the law's eyes, he's just disappeared. And so it's just adding to her complications financially. So
I'd like to follow up somewhat. I'd like to figure out an update of whether or not if she's still alive, if she, in fact, did eventually receive a judgment of, a judgment that he was legally dead. Because obviously his age, well, he'd be your mom's age, right?
Yeah, he would be a few years older than my mom.
So early 80s.
Yep. She, from what I know, went on to move. Like, she moved out of state, I think she remarried. She hopefully found some happiness and something, you know, happy at the end of all of this. But yeah, I don't know if she's still living or not, but just a strange case, like, you know, one of those things where kind of becomes an urban legend in a small town where people, you know,
everyone has their opinion.
Yeah, everyone has their opinion.
Even within your family. Tell me about your family.
Yeah,
you're the split decision on this.
So most of us believe that he suffered an accident and he, like, you know, was out boating, enjoying himself, and he fell off or something happened and he passed away. My sister is pretty convinced that he... I laugh because she's the most cynical of us, I guess. She thinks it was all part of an elaborate plot, and he was faking his own death. But
I don't know. I mean, that's.
But you know, to her credit, and you know, there is no evidence found, you know, definitely pointing to it being an accident. And there were several sightings of him years later. But there's always sightings in these unsolved cases. So it's, you know.
Would you like to hear my theory?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to hear your theory.
As a third party not living in your hometown?
Yeah. As someone outside of...
So I think that he was going to fake his death.
Yeah, like he...
And did it wrong.
Ooh.
And drowned. I think that maybe he...
That's an interesting take on it.
Well, because his aviators were there, like he was taking them off because he needed to see without shades on.
Yeah.
And the...
Yeah,
maybe he had scuba gear. Maybe he just...
He wasn't athletic. From what I know, he wasn't like an athletic individual. So I don't like foresee him like...
Going full James Bond on it.
No.
But he could have done something like that.
Yeah, you never know.
Admittedly,
like...
even we live off the coast of North Carolina, and,
mm-hmm.
and in the summer, it is like 80 degree water. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But Lake Michigan...
It gets choppy.
Well, even in summer, it's cold as hell.
Yeah, it's not as cold as... It's colder than here, for sure.
Well, yeah.
At least maybe tolerable...
But not if you're trying to scuba dive and you lose direction of where you are.
Not...
I think maybe he was trying, like I said, he was trying to get away, because if the boat had hit rough seas,
mm-hmm.
and he had fallen and hit his head or something, there would be evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
Or even like if he was grabbing onto the side of the boat, there would be evidence that he was, I mean, I doubt that it would magically, coincidentally throw his aviators off and put them on the top of the dash and then throwing him overboard.
Yeah.
There would be, you know, quite often when people get thrown anywhere, their shoes are there, and not to be like morose about it, but there was no evidence that he had been sent over the edge. But
yeah,
it is a mystery. And in this case, it's a mystery that's interesting to me because it doesn't have other victims physically.
Right. It's only him. And
the guy in the black hat is the one who was the victim. And there are a lot of people who are like, okay, so the bad guy
mm-hmm.
lost in the end. Well, I would have lost money, but at least it wasn't that he ended his experience as a Ponzi scheme guy becoming violent or
right.
taking it to the next level. So in that respect, I'm like, okay, it's interesting. Because
it is interesting.
The only person that disappeared or got hurt was the person who was the main perpetrator in some of these crimes that destroyed families. And do you remember when we were watching it and we were looking at the fact that it was, you said it was 1985?
Mm-hmm.
In 1985, some of these people had invested $100,000.
Yeah, which back then was...
It's like four times that much, $250,000, $60,000.
Mm-hmm.
And he was supposed to go into a restaurant endeavor with a couple. And it had completely devastated them because he was promising this money to be a partner.
No, you said Denver, but yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
In Illinois, he was... Yeah, he was like investing in... people he was close with, their what was supposed to be their new restaurant. Yeah, it is very strange, and you know, people were very sad when he disappeared because he was a figurehead within the community. But then, like, as people started finding out that he was, you know, taking their money, essentially, it turned into anger. And
yeah,
I think people, I mean, I've never been the victim of fraud, but, you know, I think you just want, not only do you want your money back, but you want them to, you know,
do their time.
Do their time.
But not serve, die.
Not die. Like, yeah. He was a likable guy, but, like, you need to serve your time and you need to face your judgment on what you did. And it's just, it's a weird case, and it's weird that, you know, my family kind of, like, knew of him, and my mom had, like, interacted with him, and,
Interesting stuff. That's definitely one that I don't think we'll ever solve the mystery for.
No, unless anyone listening has theories.
Who knows?
Clues.
We could be the platform where we actually get this solved. But interesting story. Nice local hometown connection.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, that was an amazing mystery segment, and we're going to move on to our next. And we'll be right back with more Robot Love.
Hello, everyone. Do you have your own business? Do you have employees? Good. Good for you. But guess what? You need HR. Well, why do I need HR? Because you're required to, and it's a great thing. Please, don't handle it yourself. Talk to my friends, and they are my friends, at WorkSmartHRLLC.com. Now you might be asking me, what do they do? Well, what don't they do? Do you need desktop services? Do you need help with the hiring process? Do you need HR custom toolkits and pay and position management? They do all that. Let's take something for example, an employee handbook. People don't really think about this when they're hired to a new job. They think, this is the packet they give me. It's the folder I have before I start actually doing my job. Au contraire, an employee handbook is extremely important because you need to set expectations for your employees. What if I'm late 3 times? Well, this is what's going to happen. Well, what if I'm not actually doing my job? This is going to happen. The government requires you to tell people exactly what your expectations are and to follow a process following that. Now, what about pay and position management? Well, don't really pick up your spreadsheet. Everybody hates doing spreadsheets. I hated them, and I hate them to this day. Let WorkSmartHRLLC.com take care of these things. Do you need to deal with HR vendors and technology? Well, they can be the bridge to that. Do you need to take care of employee records? Yes, you do need to take care of employee records. Who doesn't? But you may not have known that. Let's talk to them. You talk to them. www.WorkSmartHRLLC.com. Talk to these experts. I can't tell you any more about HR. I just know what I know from talking to them. Call them today at 603-836-4947. www.WorkSmartHRLLC.com. Thanks.
And now back to Robot Love, our next case on Unsolved, Amnesia. So Craig Williamson, he's a 46-year-old man, and he was, there's some odd twists in this, so bear with me. He was hoping to start fish farming with his new wife that he had recently met, and they wanted to kind of get into the new farming business of tilapia. Tilapia became like the go-to fish, and it's now kind of a mass farm thing overseas. And so there's that. So they were planning on going cross country with these large tilapia tanks to sell to different people as, you know, fresh. So he went ahead on a trip to Colorado Springs, Colorado, which you and I are both aware of is just south of Denver. And he was there to kind of scout out places to sell fish, make connections and things like that. He had rented a car and had several business appointments. So on the 30th of August at 9 p.m., he called his wife from the hotel. And that was the last she heard from him. Now, Craig was supposed to return home the next day, but he never arrived. That day, his credit cards were discovered at a market in El Paso, Texas. And that's actually 675 miles south of Colorado Springs. Now, 2 weeks later, his car was found in Juarez, Mexico, just across the border. And that put the state of Colorado into an investigative role. They said that there was no evidence in the vehicle of foul play. So his wife went to Colorado Springs and found his luggage still in the hotel room with, you know, no obvious signs of foul play once again. So it was a mystery, and they had investigated, you know, talked to people on bus routes and talked to people around town to see if they had seen this gentleman. And a nurse from Montana, 2 weeks after his disappearance, was on a bus traveling from Montana to Washington. I'm sorry, on a train.
I love how the buses and trains, like...
They're always an active participant in the story. They're kind of mysterious. It's not,
yeah,
like, you know,
like
somebody...
What kind of characters are they questioning?
What kind of characters have you met?
Buses and trains.
Have you taken a Greyhound?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's excruciating.
That's not to, you know, I...
No, I'd still take a Greyhound.
I wouldn't.
I hate flying. I would take a Greyhound if it was less than 1,000 miles.
I wouldn't because I get motion sick. But anyways, continue.
She had said that she had seen a gentleman of his description being very disoriented on the bus, mm-hmm. Being kind of picked on by people and him going in and out of descriptions of having fish and fish tanks and things like that. So chances are it was him. So in 1995, Craig saw... a repeat of, you know, the pending mystery of where he was, and he recognized himself. At that time, he was living in Key West, Florida, which is hilarious because he looks just like Ernest Hemingway, a dead ringer.
Yeah.
So maybe that's some kind of self-fulfilling dream to be.
Yeah, probably
Ernest Hemingway. So he said. So now he says that he remembers what happened. So maybe this kind of like got his memory going. But he says he was mugged in Colorado Springs and developed amnesia, which is something that worsened due to the concussion that he suffered the month before he disappeared. He said he couldn't remember much else from the attack, claiming that he woke up in a hospital with the name Ron. This is why these amnesia stories get picked apart sometimes by you and I.
Yeah.
So he woke up in the hospital with this name that had been assigned to him, Ron. And he claimed that he had been wandering aimlessly throughout the United States before arriving in Key West, where he found a job as a diver. So there is a last part of this, but I want you to tell me a little bit about your thoughts about
amnesia
in general. Because I know you and I have talked about it. We've seen, the 4 or 5 of them?
Yeah, and I don't know the percentage, but I'm going to say there's a common theme that runs throughout all of them, and it's a male who's recently married or has a wife or a significant other that they're trying to maybe get away from. And so they, there's some element there of a relationship that no one's saying it's gone awry, but there's definitely that undercurrent. If you just kind of peel back the layers a little bit, it feels like maybe there was something going on where this individual has created this grand story because it was easier for whatever reason than just breaking up.
Well, I think that somebody would
or
probably
getting a divorce.
Yeah, I think in some cases someone would just bang their head with a wrench and cause actual amnesia.
Yeah, but that I was reading about amnesia, and I don't know. I don't have personal experience. You've never had amnesia.
Not that I can recall.
Nah. We don't know anyone who's had amnesia, and. Apparently, like, forgetting who you are, like, the essence of you, who you are and your name and things like that, that's very uncommon in cases of amnesia. It's more that you forget you can't retain new memories. Or you have, like, a temporary bout where you forget everything, but it does come back to you. So these cases where it's these, like, long, I don't know, maybe a doctor can weigh in on this because I'd be curious, but... It seems like it seems like a plot device, right? Like, I need to uproot my life. I don't want to do this anymore. And so I'm just going to I'm just going to start over. And instead of just being a, you know, someone who fully owns that and admits to it, I'm just going to do it in this very elaborate, elusive way and hope for the best.
Yeah, and it's interesting from a psychological perspective, physiological perspective, that an injury can cause you to not remember who you are. However, you remember how to bathe, how to dress correctly, how to, how to drive a vehicle, things like that.
Yeah, some of the muscle memory things, maybe.
Well, I mean, but you still have, I don't know, it's complicated. It must be a very, very particular spot that needs to be damaged to have this type of amnesia, but I believe in it. I think that amnesia is very, very rare because there is a very, very fine line between amnesia, where you're cognitively able to do day-to-day tasks, and actually having brain damage. And I think that that's why people look at these and they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. Mm-hmm. You know, the chances that you're only forgetting your past and your name, but not forgetting anything else and not losing any of your other motor skills is I think, pretty, pretty rare. But
yeah. This one in particular seemed a little suspect, but
yeah,
there was that other one involved. Brian and I spent like a whole 3 months just watching Unsolved Mysteries every single night.
Nightmares.
But there was one with a guy named Pierre, and he like couldn't remember anything at all, and he didn't have any like connections to people where you could see him wanting to like escape a situation. So his felt a little more realistic, whereas this one, it kind of felt like this guy maybe was just trying to again uproot his life.
Yeah, you
who knows?
We'll call this a true mystery before we move on. Now, you have a couple episodes that you picked to go through, which I'm intrigued to hear a little bit more about. You had a couple. You had the two boys that were found on the train tracks, correct?
Yeah, that one is very intense. And I think it's intense because there's so many layers to it. It's one that I guess there's been a few documentaries done about it. I haven't seen the documentaries yet, but what happened was, and this is one from season one. Seems like the first season had some good stories.
Well, yeah, they had a lot
of... came in, guns a-blazing. But yeah, the story is there was two high schoolers, Don Henry and Kevin Ives. Their bodies were discovered when a train conductor spotted them on the train tracks. He made an emergency stop, but was unable to brake in time. And the boys, the whole time this was happening, which I can imagine is only like a couple seconds, at most like 30 seconds, I don't know. They were laying motionless the whole time as this train was barreling down towards them. And the conductor, unfortunately, couldn't stop in time and ran into them and thought it was just a tragic accident. But they did an autopsy and revealed that they were already dead, or at least one of them was already dead. The other one was unconscious. And so they did an autopsy and they found out that they had marijuana in their system. And originally the police or the medical examiner was like, oh, they had the equivalent of 20. I'm giggling. It's not funny.
They said marijuana cigarettes.
Marijuana cigarettes. And they said there was 20 in their system at the time. And, you know, this was back in the 80s. So we're coming from Colorado, like our idea of marijuana is very different than marijuana in the 80s, which is its own whole episode, I'm sure.
That yeah.
I'm not, you know,
I don't think that you could smoke 20.
No, that's quote, what I was going to say.
Marijuana cigarettes. Like, I speak from Colorado. It's like even the hardcore people we know who smoke marijuana, it's like, nah, it'd be like, what are you like smoking four at once?
Yeah, like how do you do that? And like, what's, unless it's like it's really bad ditch weed, and even then, like
ditch weed,
it's a lot. So, But there was a lot of inconsistency straight out of the gate. Like, as they started talking to the train conductor, he told them that they had a tarp over their bodies and that they were laid, like, in this parallel position. And so there was, like, all these things that kind of came out that were like, this was not an accident. This was premeditated. Somebody placed them on the train tracks. And so the parents were very upset, right? You know, as parents would be, you lost your children, and now you have a medical examiner basically saying there are these, like, stoners and, like, attaching this negative context to them. And so the parents asked that they do another examination. Another medical examiner came, and that was the examiner who said that they were actually dead at the time, or the other one was, like, essentially almost dead. And so they pushed to get it ruled as a homicide. And then they started investigating what was happening leading up to this. The boys went hunting that night. They were doing something called spotlighting, where you take a flashlight and you use it to disarm your prey by just flashing a light in their eyes. So that's it's easier. But apparently there was witnesses who came forward and said that there was a man in fatigues. They kept emphasizing this man in fatigues who was spotted lurking in that area. And that same man apparently had been spotted lurking in that area a week prior. And actually the police went to see what was going on, and that man shot at them. So you have this, like, suspect character witnessed as being there twice within, like, a week time frame. He was there the night of the murder. Just a lot of weirdness around this case.
And there was a similar case 200 miles away.
Yeah, there was a similar case that same positioning of the bodies, same kind of age of the boys, just some strange other similarities there. And what they don't talk about in this episode, but I've read online, and I think they go into more detail in the documentaries, is there's, like, this element that the police maybe were, like,
covering up
something, and that the boys had seen something that they probably shouldn't have seen, and there was, like, a drug connection. So definitely just one of those cases that I think stands out because there's just so many strange elements to it, and people kind of have been captivated by it. And you have the parents, you know, doing everything in their power to keep the case open. The mother, right up until she passed away, was advocating for answers, and apparently just passed away very recently, like within last year or two, I think. So you can just imagine her heartbreak having no resolution to this case. And it's been, you know, almost...
It's been 30 years plus, right? Well, and then you had mentioned to me before the podcast that there was a a subsequent autopsy after the original autopsy where they had discovered that they were actually alive. I'm sorry, that they had passed away before the train had hit them. Mm-hmm. There was a certain way to... And that the estimate of 20 marijuana cigarettes was down to 1 to 3.
Yes. Yeah. Which, yeah, because originally they tried to attach it to that they had smoked too much and passed out on the train tracks, and the reason why they weren't moving when the train was approaching was because they had fallen asleep. But in actuality, it was only 1 to 3, and they couldn't move because they essentially were already dead, and the one was completely unconscious. So
how the first autopsy got away with
unconscious, I can't say that word.
Unconscious. Yeah, unconscious. I can't say it either. Too many N's and C's. So yeah, is there anything else you want to say about that before we move on to the second? Because you have a spooky one.
No, nothing to say. To say about it. Other than, like, that one, of the all the ones we've seen, that one has just stayed with me personally. I think just because there were so many, like, strange inconsistencies, and definitely worth digging into more if you're into cold cases and crime stories. I think that's a good one to peel back the layers a little bit more on, because from what it sounds like, there's all these other elements that Unsolved Mysteries didn't even touch upon.
Yeah, one of the types of Unsolved Mysteries, obviously Unsolved Mysteries, is when there isn't an update. Mm-hmm. There's nothing more satisfying during an Unsolved Mysteries episode when they don't go update.
Yeah.
And then they say, you know, so-and-so's been captured, so-and-so.
They have that music.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible.
You know,
it was so exhilarating when I was a kid, because I'm like, the reason I like crime shows and cold case shows is I like to see the person get caught. And I like to see how they figured out, pardon me, who this person's alias was, and, you know, the fact that they got a certain amount of prison time.
Mm-hmm.
For another discussion, I'm always pointing out to Eileen watching these shows that a person that does a terrible crime in one state gets 16 years.
Yeah, it's state by state, and it's crazy how different.
There's no standard sentencing practice mm-hmm. throughout the states. And, you know, some states have the death penalty, some states don't. Every time I see a crime that's committed in Texas, I'm like, oi. It's pretty much automatic death penalty for first-degree murder.
Yeah, there are a lot more.
And, you know, other states, it's there are factors and multiple different misdemeanors and other felonies, and then they consider them concurrently and you know, like that. But that's for another podcast. Awesome. Well, I think that was a really good perspective on that story, and I think we're gonna watch that documentary.
Yeah, I think
it's tragic, and it's compelling, because it doesn't matter how long it takes. Even if the person who committed this murder is, you know, more than likely passed away, it'd be good to figure out why and how a person could become, you know, such a monster.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other ones that we love to see, these are my favorite ones, are the ghosts ones. Not so much the UFO episodes. I know you like the UFO episodes, but the ghost
I like
ones...
them because we had read at some point that those ones like made Robert Stack uncomfortable.
Oh, he didn't buy them.
He didn't buy them. Like he, they were harder for him to digest, and I think he saw the appeal in them from like the, I'm sure from like the TV. Viewership standpoint, but I think as an individual, he thought those were a little too off the wall and probably didn't believe in UFOs himself personally. But even though my last name is Stack, I can't speak for Robert Stack.
Somewhere down the line, that was like, when are we going to talk about that? That you are actually not related directly to Robert Stack.
I tried to see if there was a connection, and there isn't, unfortunately. Yeah, of course. There's got to be some connection.
It's the same last name.
Back in time, but...
There could be two parallel stacks that developed as two separate family lineages.
I couldn't find anything, though, just in my quick query. I would love to have said that he was a relative, but...
I would love to be able to say that I was married to a relative of...
Robert Stack?
I'm pretty okay just being... married to Eileen Stack.
A regular stack.
A run-of-the-mill stack.
Is his trench coat in a museum somewhere?
I don't know.
Like, that kind of is like a...
It should be in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, you would think, right? It's up there with the ruby slippers.
That and...
maybe...
Well, I think it could be in the same building as Max... what's the coat that he wears? The Australian coat.
Oh, his duster.
His duster, the leather duster.
Yeah, oh, and there's an Always Sunny museum, but
that's another podcast. Because, on a side note, I love Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and Eileen had never seen it, and she'd walk into the room, she's like, "Why are they all yelling at each other?
They're always getting in fights, and I always feel bad for Dee." But
she's in on it, you know. She's in on the joke, and she's a great actress. But
do you want to talk about? You were talking about ghost stories, and then you went into UFOs. Did you want to talk about...
I'd like to talk about the death chair.
The death chair.
And that's one that you researched.
Yeah.
It was chilling.
That one was from season 10. And I forget now, of course I'm missing the core details here, but essentially there was a nefarious character named Thomas Busby who was sentenced to death. And before he was having his last drink at a pub or doing something where he was sitting on this chair, and as he was about to like essentially go to the gallows, he said, this chair is cursed. And he didn't say it like that, but he like cursed the chair. And from then on, there's all these stories about this cursed chair causing people to have accidents. And not only were they accidents that resulted in their death, and not only were they like accidents that happened, they happened pretty quickly. Like
right after they sat in the chair,
like,
within a day.
Yeah, within like a day or a few weeks of them sitting in the chair. One was a story around a few Air Force pilots. I should say first that the chair was in a pub. And so you can imagine as people are drinking, they're egging each other on, and people are daring each other to sit in this chair.
It sat there empty because everybody was afraid to sit in it, but it was
the
there.
The locals probably were like, I'm never getting into that thing. There was like a story of one woman accidentally fell into it or like got pushed into it by accident, and she had the curse fall onto her. But there was cases a lot of times like involving soldiers who were out, you know, celebrating, and they would have a little too much to drink, challenge one another. One of them would sit in it. One time it was three soldiers who... one of them sat in it in their party, and they all died in a car crash. There was a case of bricklayers who were working in that area. They went to the pub to have a drink. Again, they were kind of, I think it was two, they were egging each other on to sit in the chair. One of them did. He fell like that day on the job site off a ladder. And then they... eventually, the pub moved it down to the basement because they wanted to try and, like, eliminate the power of this chair, at least, like, remove it so it would make it safer for their patrons. But they still, somehow, in the basement, people...
it's elevated.
Well, now it's in a museum.
Yeah, I remember, so they hang it up on the wall so that people can't sit in it, right?
Yeah, like, they've made it... completely impossible to sit in there because it's literally 5 feet on the wall. But yeah, what do you think about like objects being possessed or haunted or curses? You told people you had kind of like an interesting religious upbringing.
Yeah, we can talk about that in another podcast. But I was raised in a church that was... It was a church that believed in Christ, but it was also a church that believed in the teachings of different people like Edgar Cayce and the use of crystals and reincarnation and different things like that, and spiritual, tapping into the spiritual world, but still around the basis of Christianity. But I do, in fact, believe in objects that can hold on to negative energy or... mm-hmm. I guess to be cursed. I mean, there's a certain amount with certain objects I think is psychological, that people believe that they're cursed,
mm-hmm.
and can even in a subconscious way actually create these disasters, these curses. But
like a self-fulfilling prophecy almost?
Yeah, I think so. But I'm a guy that believes in ghosts. I believe in pretty much everything supernatural. That can be cannot be disproven. I don't believe in everything that people say, but I've had some experiences. You and I have had some experiences that we'll talk about on another podcast. That, I mean, when we started dating, you were definitely a skeptic, and you're mm-hmm. still have a analytical, skeptical mind.
Yeah,
logical mind, not skeptical, but logical.
I err on the side of skepticism, but yes.
Well, you also have a master's degree in anthropology, so you're a very scientific-minded person.
Soft science.
Soft science. Sorry.
On the cultural side, when we're soft science, there is the hard science of like archaeologists, but that's neither. Well, anyways, yeah. So
all science is hard to me.
I do have that skeptic musical sensibility, but I think you have kind of opened my eyes to other things. And
I brainwashed you into believing in ghosts. That's even spookier than ghosts. My power. Yeah,
you and I have had some hair-raising experiences, and I think you just tapped into something there that,
Multiple states, multiple trips. I have quite a few stories from when I was a kid.
You have a lot. You should do... We keep saying this is another podcast, but you should absolutely do one on, like, at least your ghost stories. But
do you know what we should do? We should do a podcast that's called This Is For Another Podcast. Don't steal that out there.
That's like Inception of podcasts.
Inception, is that?
Like Inception of podcasts.
We just peeling back the layers.
Yeah. Anyways.
We've already covered 45 minutes. So what I wanted to talk about briefly is an episode that was very tragic. It's a tragic episode, and I don't want anyone to think that we don't appreciate the tragedy of what happened. However, it is where Matthew McConaughey was discovered.
Yeah. This is a crazy one.
This is a crazy episode, and he did distinguish himself with some pretty good acting. He was a little dramatic, but this was his first gig. I can't remember if he had commercials or not before this, but this was his first actual televised role.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very tragic case that happened in 1992. A gentleman named Larry Dickens, who was an ex-Marine and was living with his mother and was a young father, and he was in an altercation in the street with a person who was a sexual predator, as they found out later, who was driving around in his truck and was approaching kids who were playing and exposing himself. And apparently later it came out that he had murdered almost a dozen young people. So Matthew McConaughey is playing Larry Dickens, and Larry Dickens looks out and sees this happening and runs out and basically takes the keys out of his car and says, "We're getting the police here. You're not going anywhere."
Mm-hmm.
Well, he didn't know that this killer had, I believe it was a shotgun. He had several. He had a World War II rifle.
He had a 22.
A shotgun. I think he did have a World War II rifle as well. But what wound up happening is...
I don't even know what a 22 is, but continue.
Wow. Ballistics expert.
Continue this.
Yeah, so what happened, in essence, he returned to the garage where Matthew McConaughey was, and he said, the Larry Dickens, and he said, "Give me those keys, I'm getting out of here," and he refused to do it. So he shot Larry Dickens multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was so tough and courageous that he would not die.
Yeah, his mom was like, kept trying to...
He was fighting back. And, mm-hmm. If the guy obviously didn't have a gun, he would have been toast. So he takes off. He drives away. Eventually, Larry Dickens dies, unfortunately.
You're missing part of this, though.
Well, he's driving.
And
Larry Dickens' sister drives by.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And sees what's going on and chases him and tries to cut him off or something.
Yeah.
But the police obviously have been called, and they start to chase this man who, later they found his name was Edward Harold Bell, which in hindsight, he died at 82 in prison, but he is on the list of serial killers. And police chased him, and he was not going down without a fight. He kind of crashed his truck into a ravine, I think, and then the police came out, and they had standard, 38 revolvers, and he had these machine guns and shotguns, and he was firing at the police, and he was not going down without a fight. Eventually he was captured. I know that there was, I wish I could remember more, but I think he escaped and was recaptured. He was living somewhere on the run. He was eventually convicted of the murder of Larry Dickens, and was also... He wasn't tried, but there was a lot of evidence that he had killed 11 other people. And so I think the takeaway from this is it's a very tragic story that was handled with some really great, honest acting by Matthew McConaughey. I think that it's something that could be over the top, especially how he played it. But in an interview, he said that, you know, he did that, and then he started getting calls.
Yeah, that was kind of...
This is breakthrough.
Put him on the map, and he... You know, it's a case of there are no small parts, only
small actors.
Only small actors. Like, that was what he was given at the time, and he put everything into it, and...
He did. There were some other actors and actresses that had gotten their start, and I can't remember... Okay, so this is a flashback to an old show. Do you remember the Drew Carey Show?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the character who had brown curly hair, who was really tall?
Yeah, he was in Office Space. He was like the neighbor in Office Space.
Yes, he was the neighbor who was the construction worker.
Yeah, yeah. We should know his name.
Yeah, so
his name, we'll look it up.
He was in an episode, and I don't remember which one, but he was in a car, and they had like either murdered somebody or robbed somebody or whatnot. And, you know, of course, you can even say...
Dietrich Bader. Huh. Is that right?
Sounds about right.
Or no, that's who he played. Or no, I'm totally butchering this. I apologize.
We give updates. no, seriously, I've had in the past, I've had interviews where the person I was speaking to, both of us thought, well, that's got to be correct, but it's not correct. So I will have an update on things that we've completely gotten wrong. And
Dietrich Bader. I might not be pronouncing his last name.
Dietrich Bader.
Right, but yeah.
He's in something recently. I don't know. So anyway, there have been quite a few people who have been discovered on Unsolved Mysteries. And there is, and you can tell the ones that are going to become stars, because there is an absolute opposite acting quality.
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting thing about Unsolved Mysteries is when... Don't they say when they can, they involve the actual family members?
And, well, yeah.
The
yeah.
people who were involved, who were part of the story. So oftentimes there were real people reenacting experiences. But yeah, you can kind of see when somebody who's, you know, that's their livelihood, acting, and they just take it to that level of...
They do, and one of the things that you and I were speaking about today when we were doing our final prep for the show is that there were some rather unfortunate cases during the lifespan of the show where people who were playing the wanted people, actors were being recognized on the street and being turned in, citizen arrested, mm-hmm. things like that, because they... You know, and that's one of the things
they were so believable.
So believable. So believable. And you know, it's an incredible show. And I wish we had more time to talk about more episodes, but I think that we kind of did a representation of some of the different categories. We're gonna have you back to talk about some really intense ones, from the ghost side, and some UFO ones.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you would, I mean, you're right here. We can put something together, but I know that. And just briefly, I want you to talk about the thing that scared the heck out of me most, and it was the intro music.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can't do this podcast without mentioning the music, because it is iconic. You know that everyone who grew up knows that song, and you know, just kind of chills you to the bone. And there's been different iterations of it throughout the years. As we were watching, like, consecutively over like however long,
20 some years, yeah.
But as you and I were binging it was funny, we could see like season one, you have the original song, and then by like season six, they start adding this like drum beat to it, and then
softening the curves.
Yeah, and like, just, you can see like as the decades are kind of changing, they're trying to like experiment with the sound, and it was almost like the more they added elements to it, up until like season 10, it becomes like very overly done. They were kind of losing some of that spooky factor. And I guess like one of the main reasons why that song is so spooky is because it uses this thing called a tritone, which I'm not a musician, I'm not a composer, obviously I didn't study musical theory, but it's a certain combination of tones that creates this sense of tension, and when you're listening to it, you can feel it. Like, it feels like slightly off kilter in your ear, like it works but it doesn't at the same time, and so it kind of automatically puts you on edge. And
there's a combination of things where when you have a minor note,
mm-hmm.
you're expecting the major, you're expecting some kind of a combination with, and it's like having all minor notes, it's like having things that don't make sense, and it's just chaos.
Yeah, there's some element to it that like shouldn't work but does enough where
it's disorienting.
It's disorienting, and they call it the devil's interval.
Well done.
And I guess the original was composed by Gary Malkin and Michael Boy, maybe Michael Bay. The cool thing though is that if you've watched the newest Unsolved Mysteries, like the recent version that came out on Netflix,
mm-hmm. which are crazy,
and those ones are cool because they do a really nice homage to like the essence of the show, but instead of doing these little like vignettes where they're maybe covering six stories within one show, they're covering just one case, and they're mm-hmm. doing this like deeper dive. And I think like because of Netflix and some of these other crime shows, like people are kind of loving that format of like these mini series or these documentary style approaches to crime where you are just, you know, you're learning every aspect of the case as much as known to the people involved, and you're in it like trying to solve as you go. But they did, in my opinion, that composer, whose name is Wes Dylan Thordson, I guess he did that movie Joy and some other movies, but I think he did a really good job of like honoring the original score. He almost toned it down a little bit, like made it a little more palatable, but he gave it kind of like an update without like going, you know, too far away from the original.
It's a really polished beginning, and it's got these cool homages. Like at the end, there's this shadowy figure of Robert Stack's trench coat.
Right.
I was like, what?
I wonder how Robert Stack would feel about the new season. I think he would like it. I think he would like that. Like, people have loved his show for so long that here we are, like, this whole new generation of people wanting to watch and wanting to be a part of solving these mysteries and bringing closure to families who've lost people, or just understanding the things that are undefined about this universe. And I can't speak for Robert Stack,
well,
but I think he would probably feel some source of pride that it's been so salient, like, throughout his lifetime. It went for how long did it go? Was it?
I can tell you in the trivia.
Yeah, like, it's like The Simpsons, almost, and, you know, it's like The Simpsons in the sense for my entire lifetime, almost. This show has been a part of my world. Just like The Simpsons for me has pretty much been on the whole time I've been on this planet. So,
yeah.
I mean,
no, it's
remarkable.
Robert Stack is Unsolved Mysteries. And because of him, I mean, he was a trailblazer. And because of Unsolved Mysteries, you get shows like America's Most Wanted. And America's Most Wanted was We're not going to do things about mysterious.
Yeah, like no mysterious fluff. Things. Forget
no fluff. No mystery sightings. No UFOs and no ghosts.
No, your favorite long lost loves and.
They may have had a couple of those, but he focused on getting the criminal, getting the person who was, suspected of these murders, and he's just. It was amazing. They've done so much and they've caught so many people. So that was kind of something that came, out of the genre of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd like to jump into some trivia.
Let's do it.
All right. Okay. This is not easy trivia. Okay. It's more of an informative trivia because it's almost impossible for you to know all of them.
Yes.
But it'll answer some of the questions that you had earlier.
Should I at least attempt to answer?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Okay. So, how many episodes have aired of Unsolved Mysteries? As of 2020.
I know it's a lot. Like.
Yes.
Not 1,000. I don't think. Over 500?
Yes. That's a great guess. You were within, 593 episodes.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's surprising, but yeah. Again, going back to like how long it's been on air, and you and I have probably watched.
I probably watched 95%.
Yeah.
I would watch.
You probably watched 95%.
My dad
probably
and I
have caught like 70% of them.
Yeah, I mean that's a great run. So the second trivia question I have is, how many mysteries have been solved according to the Unsolved Mysteries website?
Is someone still like moderating that and updating it?
Yeah, oh, that's cool. It's a cool 1990s website that's still going, and you can still press a button in the middle of the homepage that says "Report a Tip."
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it's still now. As you saw in the later episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, where they had like these Star Wars looking lights in a room and people were talking and taking tapes. And they were like not saying
anything.
There's
no like command center where there's
like the Pentagon. That's.
Just tell me the answer for this one because I'm not going to know.
650 mysteries.
Have been solved?
Have been solved. Approximately half of all presented mysteries.
Wow. That's.
Yeah, that's incredible. And without this show.
I almost feel like it's maybe even.
I think more have been solved after the series stopped.
Yeah, I was going to say, because like one episode typically had like 4-5 segments. So that means that there were probably people solving them.
They would even do additional airings of certain ones in different episodes later without updates. Just
re-airing them.
Yeah, re-airing them within an episode.
What was that guy's name? Dennis Farina?
Dennis Farina.
Yeah, I know there was some that re-aired with him.
He was a host after Robert Stack. And that goes to our next trivia question, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
How many hosts, as far as my research can tell, how many hosts have there been for Unsolved Mysteries? This includes special reporter guests, which there weren't that many, and co-hosts. He had a female co-host for a while.
Oh God, I don't remember a female co-host. When was that?
Yeah, it was midway through it. So apparently the ratings had slumped a little bit, so he had Virginia Madsen as a co-host.
She's cool.
Yeah, she's totally cool. And then there was another one, Pierce Brosnan's wife, I think. I don't want to throw things out there that I'm not really sure of, but I counted them.
Six?
Good guess, seven.
Seven?
Seven. Very good guess. You're on fire. These are really abstract, very hard ones to answer.
Well, you and I, again, have just watched a lot of Unsolved, and
I can close my eyelids and see Robert Stack at this point. Just burned into my pupils. Okay, so next trivia question. What movie that was a comedy was Robert
Airplane.
Stack? I didn't even get it out.
Come on, I know
that. Yes, Robert Stack as Captain Rex Kramer. And he had some hilarious moments. And he played kind of the straight guy who was really serious but was hilarious. I don't know if he was in the second one, but the first one
good.
He was really good.
We saw him on Conan.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was, like, very jovial, and smart. You could tell he was just, like, having a good time. And
having a really good time.
Conan was kind of, like...
There was some hero worship on Conan.
Yeah, a little in awe, which...
Yeah,
you know.
So, here's a next trivia question. What state was Matthew McConaughey born in? It's part of his identity, and this is, like... His accent's right from, I think it's from that one particular part of the state.
I'm laughing because this feels left field, but I see the tie-in because he was born in Texas, right?
Yeah, he's from Texas.
And the episode that the segment he was on took place in Texas.
So that's
right.
That ties in.
Is that the connection?
I just wanted you to figure out where he's from.
Everyone knows where Matthew McConaughey is from.
This one is...
He drives a Lincoln.
He does, and that's that's hilarious. Last trivia question.
Mm-hmm.
What is my favorite fruit? I talk about fruit a lot.
Why are you... Is this just because it's me that you're giving random...
Yeah, well, this is just...
Because I'm your wife.
Yeah, so because you're my wife, and I really appreciate...
Aw, shucks. You have a few favorites. Is this a trick question?
Well, it's not a trick question.
You like peaches?
Right.
Watermelon?
I would also accept cherries or watermelon.
Thank you.
Thanks for indulging me in something that's not
I have a question
so
for
mysterious.
You.
Yes.
Not so much a trick. Maybe, I think I'm your first guest who, we're doing this in person
because
we live together.
Yeah.
As partners do most of the time, not always, but we live together, so we're doing this together in person. Am I your first guest that you've done a podcast with in person? I think you've
Well, up to the pandemic, I was pretty much doing maybe half in person, half by telephone. I've probably done
That's right. When we were
four in person,
when we were in Denver, you were able to do a few in person.
Yeah, I did Noah Van Shiver. I did him by phone because he was in North Carolina at the time when I was in Denver. And ironically, we live in North Carolina.
Yeah, right? Now here we are.
We're in the South, and it's amazing. I don't think I'd ever go live anywhere that snowed again. I mean, we can talk wherever. You're from Northern Illinois. I'm from Denver. And not having it be that cold, well, it kind of makes you a little bit spoiled. So when we had this last winter, it was like, it got down to like 25 one day, and everybody's freaking out, and all the toilet paper and canned food disappears from the store.
Yeah,
but that's just part of living
in
the
South. It's a whole different winter here, different thing.
A whole different ball game.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like we went over an hour, and it's fantastic, and I want to thank you because you are an amazing partner, and you are one of the smartest people I've ever known, and you are a good sport for coming on to the podcast, because I know that it's hard being interviewed by your husband.
Well, thank you for having me, and now I'm blushing, and you're obviously biased, but I really enjoyed myself, and I'd love to hear, you know, people's thoughts on some of the things we talked about, like what your listeners think about amnesia and reincarnation and all those things too. And
absolutely.
Keep the conversation going, right?
Keep the conversation going. You can contact me via email, brian.venegas@gmail.com. And I'll also, after the interview, I'll give you some other ways to contact me. I want to hear from people around the world, because I think it just blows my mind that there are people in about 11 countries that listen to me, at this crazy, amateur, weird podcast. But I'm just curious how the podcast got to these different countries. And I want to hear from you, and I'd really like to hear from people who have ideas for podcasts or have experiences that they want to talk about. And eventually, I would like to integrate calls, and I would like to integrate perhaps having a podcast with a fan.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can do it from anywhere in the world because I can actually do it via phone. Thank you.
Thank you, honey. I had a good time.
Eileen Stack.
Thank you, Robot Love.
That's right. And I will talk to you on the next Robot Love, and I promise it will not be a month and a half between shows.
Yeah.
So, okay, my name is Brian Mateo Venegas, and I'm going to bid you a good night from Robot Love.
Thank you for listening to Robot Love Podcast. Remember to check out Brian's comic, Rotoro, at rotorocomic.com.